Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a bit of a shorter video. It's called Four Proofs in 4 Minutes That Jesus is God. I do not have high expectations for this one. I feel like 4 minutes is going to end up leaving out a lot of nuance, and these arguments for God generally require a lot of nuanced misdirection and obfuscation. So this could be like shooting fish in a barrel, but this is a somewhat popular video, so I figure it's worth addressing. Let's go!
Christianity stands or falls on the premise that Jesus is God.
All right, starting strong with a statement that I can agree with.
So, is he? Here are four classic proofs in 4 minutes. First, Jesus said he was God.
Yeah, it's not really a proof. In fact, it's difficult to say for sure that he even said he was a god, as the only places where he says that are in books that were written decades after the fact by non-eyewitness anonymous authors. All that aside, even if I grant this, it's not exactly proof that the statement is correct. I can claim to be God too, that doesn't make it true. I am God, and as God, I proclaim that there are actually no gods, so I was just God long enough to make sure that atheism is true. There, you should all be atheists now if this is the standard of evidence that we're using.
I know, it doesn't sound like much proof, but think about it.
I have thought about it. It's an incredibly easy claim to make, and one that people do make on a fairly regular basis.
If he didn't claim to be God, then why should anyone else?
I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying that the only reason anyone claims to be God is because Jesus did so first? Well, what about all the kings and warlords and whatnot who claim to be gods of one variety or another all throughout history, both before and after Jesus? Or are you just focusing on the people who have claimed to be the second coming of Jesus? Because there are a bunch of those too, and sure, I guess they wouldn't bother making that claim if people didn't believe that Jesus was God in the first place, but that's kind of like saying you have me to thank for the fact that the firefighters put out the fire in your house, because if I hadn't started the fire, they wouldn't have come by to save you. Except in this analogy, the firefighters are grifters who are fanning the flames, all while pretending to be putting them out for profit.
When Israel's high priest asked Jesus whether he was the Messiah, Jesus responded, "I am." When Jesus was confronted by a crowd of Jewish skeptics, he said, "Before Abraham was born, I am." And when Peter proclaimed him to be the Christ, Jesus confirmed that indeed he is.
The interesting thing about this is that in Judaism, the Messiah, or the Christ, is not supposed to be a god or demigod. He's supposed to be a man, a political leader who is descended from King David, and he will lead Israel to military victory, thus bringing God's kingdom here on earth. The Christian idea that the Messiah would be the Son of God was not an idea of the Messiah that was very well accepted at the time, and it may have been created as a response to the fact that the man that they were expecting to lead Israel to political and military victories against Rome ended up being crucified by the Roman authorities. The Messiah is not supposed to come to that sort of an end, so they found scriptures that kinda hinted at that sort of thing and then reinterpreted them to be referring to Jesus, and made sure to include references to those scriptures in the stories that were written about him. And, in Jewish culture of the time, this was a perfectly acceptable practice. Ancient rabbis considered a text to be dead when you could no longer find new meanings in it. You're supposed to be able to reinterpret the same text to have a new meaning. So this might seem weird to us in this day and age when Christians will loudly proclaim that the Bible is the inerrant, unchanging word of God and must be interpreted in the way that they approve of, but this attitude had not yet developed when early Christians were first getting started. All this to say that, at the time, claiming to be the Messiah was not the same as claiming to be God, though certainly the authors of at least a couple of the Gospels did want to portray him as making that claim by using the "I am" phrasing that matches the "I am that I am" statement that God used to introduce himself to Moses.
So one proof, if you will, is Jesus' own testimony to his deity. And as C.S. Lewis said so well, someone who claims to be God is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord.
Or legendary, or their claim was made on their behalf by later authors, or he actually did say those things, but he wasn't meaning for them to be interpreted as him claiming to be God. The most explicit I am God statements come from the Gospel of John, the latest gospel to be written, and the one that seems to go out of its way to directly contradict the other three. So an argument could be made that Jesus claiming to be God in John was written specifically to contradict the view of Jesus as the human man who was adopted as the Son of God at his baptism that can be found in Mark. So, really, it's interesting that the most explicit statements that can be interpreted as Jesus claiming to be God comes in the latest of the Gospels, with the earlier ones being ambiguous at best.
So we've got to choose one of those. He can't just be a great moral teacher.
I'd argue that he's not even a great moral teacher. So I'd suggest that things like telling people not to plan for the future are not good teachings. His best teachings are mediocre and reflect ideas commonly found in the works of other teachers that came before Jesus, but were not supposed to be gods, like the Golden Rule, which can be found in ancient Egyptian writings more than 1500 years before Jesus. And even some of his teachings that are often lauded as commendable today, like his preachings against the rich, have historically been used rather to manipulate poor people into accepting their poverty, such as in this letter to colonial missionaries written by King Leopold II of Belgium in 1883, where he says, "And make sure that they never become rich. Sing every day that it is impossible for the rich to enter heaven." Also, it's possible for liars to preach good moral teachings. It usually ends up making them hypocrites, but even if his teachings were uncommonly good, it's still possible for him to have lied about being God while teaching them. It's also possible for people with mental illness to be good people and teach good things. To suggest that this is not possible is kinda gross, to be honest. So even if I grant that his teachings are good, he could still have been lying about being God or have come to believe that he was through untreated mental illness.
Besides his own testimony, there's also the testimony of those who personally knew Jesus.
Of which, we have none. Literally none. Not a single person who would have personally known Jesus wrote a single word of the Bible. Unless you ignore the scholarship, then we have books attributed to Peter, James, and John. But scholarly consensus is that these books were definitely not written by those people. Also, if we're inclined to believe whatever the Bible says about Peter and John, these books definitely wouldn't have been written by them, as they're described in Acts 4:13 as being uneducated common men. Uneducated and common would mean that they were part of the more than 90% of the population that, at the time, would have been illiterate. So we have a grand total of zero eyewitness testimonies from people who actually knew Jesus during his ministry.
His disciples and others close to him. Consider this. Jesus' disciples abandoned their occupations and their families to spread the news that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, rose from the dead.
Allegedly. According to books that, if I already accepted their claims, I would already be a believing Christian. If you want to convince a non-Christian, you need to bring some backup, some corroborating sources. Also, it would help if there weren't a random hand popping into the video to do nothing every few seconds. Okay, that's not fair, it put text on their signs, but it was incredibly distracting.
And they were willing to be beaten, and tortured, starved, jailed, and ultimately killed for sharing that message.
Those stories are even less credible than the gospel stories. If we start accepting those as true, why would we not also accept the other details of those stories? The Acts of Peter, for instance, is where we get the story of Peter's upside-down crucifixion. But that's also where we learn that Peter was in the habit of healing cripples right in front of his crippled daughter, who he refused to heal. When asked about this, he healed her just so that he could prove that he could, and then unhealed her because it would be more convenient for him. So, why do we accept the upside-down crucifixion from this story, but not the Peter being a bad father keeping his daughter crippled for his own convenience part of the story?
And that kind of martyrdom has happened in other religious traditions too, but the difference is this. These guys were actual eyewitnesses to what they were claiming.
Again, if we take the Gospels at face value. It's worse than that because we don't just have to take the Gospels at face value, we also have to take specific portions of other apocryphal books at face value as well, all the while arbitrarily dismissing the rest of those books. But, of course, cherry-picking is a favorite apologist pastime, so I can see why that wouldn't be a problem for them. But I remain unconvinced.
So how likely is it that all of them would sacrifice so much for something that they knew to be untrue?
If I say it's entirely unlikely, but that I don't believe that they actually did that in the first place, does that work? Or I could point out that it's entirely possible that they didn't think they would be sacrificing so much, but they just got in over their heads and never had a chance to get out. Because both of those options seem way more likely to me than the story of the resurrection.
We also have the contemporary eyewitness testimony about Jesus being God. there's a plethora of closely documented evidence on what are called near-death experiences.
Okay, but given that near-death experiences tend to match the culture that the person having the experience is most familiar with, rather than all NDEs being of the Christian variety, I'm not sure how this would actually count as evidence. Unless you just ignore all the other cultures' NDEs. In India, for instance, common features of an NDE are that you are forcibly brought before the Hindu god of death, Yamraj, who, after consultation with a book or papers, discovers that a mistake has been made. The wrong person has died. The messengers who force the person to appear before Yamraj then take the person back and push them down, at which point they come back to life, and shortly after their revival, someone else dies, usually someone with the same given name. Buddhists will sometimes report having a feeling of peace and oneness, with a paradise-like description of bodilessly walking through gardens or other beautiful scenes. Or on the flip side, there are also a couple Buddhist accounts of people that have toured the Buddhist hell known as Naraka. What near-death experience you have seems to be determined by the cultural expectations surrounding death. The vast majority of the time, an NDE reinforces previously held beliefs, or if the person doesn't hold the beliefs themselves, it reinforces beliefs that they are culturally familiar with. On rare occasions, religious conversions can result, but those are the exception rather than the rule, and they are not exclusively conversions to Christianity.
Thousands of adults and children on the brink of death who later report remarkable out-of-body journeys. Some of them say that they traveled to heaven and some to hell, but a sizable proportion vividly describe meeting Jesus in the afterlife.
A sizable portion here, meaning that being an American living in a largely Christian culture that is regularly inundated with stories of the Christian version of NDEs, he is mostly familiar with the Christian ones. It doesn't take much to find plenty of stories from other cultures, but if you don't look for it, you'll mostly be familiar with the ones that are dominant in the culture that you live in.
You may have heard of recent cases like that of Colton Burpo, who, when he was 4 years old, came back from a near-death experience with stunning details of heaven and Jesus.
Colton's near-death experience actually happened when he was 3. He didn't tell anybody about it until he was 4. Because kids that age are super good at keeping secrets about exciting events like that, right? Right there, that seems fishy. But Colton was also the son of an evangelical preacher, so it's not like he was completely unaware of what heaven is supposed to be in Christian theology. So it's the culture he grew up in, and he was literally a toddler when it happened. Also, given the gap between when it happened and when he told people about it, my guess would be that he honestly believes that he had the experience, and that is how he remembers it, but that it was a dream that he had later, which he shared with his parents, who got excited and reinforced the idea that it happened when he quote-unquote died. And I said died in quotes like that because there's actually no documentation to support the claim that he died on the operating table. It was an emergency appendectomy, which, while it was an emergency, that is a fairly normal procedure. And on top of all this, his story grew as time went on. He didn't tell the whole thing right away. There were new details that kept coming up over the course of about 3 years, at least according to the book. The initial NDE story that he told was just that he saw his parents praying for him, something he definitely would have known was a likely occurrence. So the idea of him dreaming about his parents doing something that they no doubt did all the time seems rather mundane, even if it did happen while he was on the operating table.
And other information that he couldn't have possibly known.
Yes, he supposedly knew that his mother had a miscarriage which she had never told him about. If that part of the story is true, I would put my money on his parents having mentioned it to other adults sometime when he was in the room with them, but not directly to him. Kids are perceptive. My kids have often brought up things that I didn't think they knew because they overheard me talking about them when I thought they weren't listening. And I don't know why the grandfather thing is supposed to be so interesting. He knew that he had a great-grandfather, even though his great-grandfather died before he was born. Okay? My kids also knew that they had great-grandparents that died before they were born when they were that age. Is that supposed to be impressive? Oh, but he identified him by pointing to a picture of him.
This is him?
Yeah, that's him. That's Pop.
Forgive me for not being impressed by someone holding up a picture and saying, "Is this who you saw?" And then the kid saying yes because he knows a yes will get him nice positive attention. Oh, but he said no when it was the picture of him as an old man, and he said yes when he was a younger man. Okay, that's nice. I still don't see how that is in any way impressive.
And you may have heard the related story of Akiana Kramerik, the daughter of atheists who, at a young age, had visions of Jesus.
Non-practicing Catholic is a funny way of saying atheist. Now, maybe they were, but she was also sent to parochial schools, that is, religious schools. She painted Jesus from her visions of him when she was 8, an age when she had already been attending these religious schools. Interesting that you leave these details out of the story.
And painted them. They didn't look at all like the typical depictions of Jesus.
You're kidding, right? They look exactly like the typical depictions of Jesus. The only real difference I see is that the hair is short and she gave him green eyes instead of blue. It's still a picture of Jesus as a man who would have stuck out like a sore thumb in first century Judea.
But Little Colton later identified those paintings as the only ones that accurately captured what Jesus actually looks like.
Yeah, he supposedly did. 3 years after his NDE, while they were watching a documentary talking about how this girl had visions of Jesus and then painting them. Was this the first time he identified any painting as actually looking like Jesus? Or had he identified others in the past that his parents just didn't recall because it was just any old painting of Jesus, so it was nothing special? But they paid attention when he did the same thing with the painting that was supposedly a vision of Jesus. That's called confirmation bias, and it happens all the time. They don't even have to be lying about it, they could honestly believe that it was the first time it happened. And even if it was, the kid was about 7 years old when he made this identification. At this point, there are years of knowing that he gets lots of positive attention from his parents when he gives them new details about his vision. It's a type of positive reinforcement that provides a perfect environment for the development of false memories.
Astonishing stories like these, and there are countless others, require an explanation.
They actually don't. What requires an explanation is the question of why you dismiss other cultures' NDEs while accepting the Christian ones. I gave a rather ad hoc explanation for the Colton Burpo NDE that I feel is plausible, but the best case scenario here is, okay, you have a Christian kid who had a Christian NDE, but there are also Hindus who have Hindu NDEs, Muslims who have Muslim NDEs, Buddhists who have Buddhist NDEs, etc., etc., etc. So why should I give special credence to this one? And that's to say nothing of the other NDEs that have happened and then gone on to have best-selling books written about them, only for the kid to come out later and admit that it was all made up, as happened with the case of the suspiciously aptly named Kevin Malarkey of the best-selling book The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven.
If you do even a little research on near-death experiences, you may find compelling modern-day evidence for the divinity of Jesus.
Or, if you do a bit of research on NDEs, you'll find that an examination of the description of the experiences matches up closely with descriptions of experiences of people on ketamine, which is a drug that acts as an NMDA receptor antagonist. Since we know that the brain also naturally contains some NMDA receptor antagonists that can be released during stressful events, like, say, almost dying, the obvious conclusion here is that a near-death experience is the result of chemical interactions in the brain. Now, other studies have found the similarities to match up more closely with DMT than ketamine, but the point is that NDEs match up with the experiences that are brought about through altering brain chemistry with drugs, and the brain chemistry alters when death approaches, or when heavy anesthetic is administered. So there's really no reason to believe that NDEs are anything more than a chemical reaction in the brain.
Further proof comes from the resurrection.
Really? That's your final proof? Dude, the resurrection is the claim here, it's not the proof. I mean, I guess strictly speaking, the claim is that Jesus is God, so if your religion holds that it's only possible for God to be resurrected, nobody else, then that would support the claim, I guess, but as an outsider, this has a bit of a, if you don't believe that I have an invisible pet dragon, then why is there a hoard of invisible, intangible gold in my garage feel to it? Like, I guess the gold in my garage would be decent evidence for the dragon, but if I can't prove that the gold is there either, then how does that help us with the dragon claim?
Jesus rising again after his death and appearing to hundreds of people.
Again, allegedly. Throughout all the New Testament, we have exactly one person who actually claims themselves to have seen the risen Jesus, that one person being Paul, and he describes it as a vision rather than a physical encounter, so it doesn't really help the case.
What mere mortal does that sort of thing?
Samuel came back from the dead to give Saul advice. The kids whose dead bodies Elijah and Elisha laid on top of. Lazarus. Some random dude whose body was thrown into the same grave as Elisha, who rose when his body touched Elisha's bones. Jairus' daughter. The man at Nain. A bunch of people during the crucifixion. Tabitha. Eutychus? Whatever that name is pronounced as. The two witnesses of Revelation. Etc., etc., etc. And these are just the resurrections in Christian theology. If we want to bring in other claimed resurrections, then we have competing gods in the mix, Odin, for example. My point is, if the existence of a claim of a resurrection is proof that the person who resurrected is God, then there are a lot of gods, even just within Christianity. So, no, I don't believe that Jesus came back from the dead, and even if I did, that would not actually in and of itself be proof that he was God. It would certainly be a step in that direction, but as your own theology allows for non-God resurrections, it's not even proof by the standards of your theology.
One of the more elegant arguments for the historicity of the resurrection comes from Professor Gary Habermas.
The man who makes George R.R. Martin look like a speedy writer. He's been working on what is supposed to be his magnum opus, a several thousand page long monstrosity that proves once and for all that Jesus rose from the dead, for much longer than I've even been aware of his existence. And it's fine that it's taking a long time. Serious scholarly work can sometimes take decades to complete. The problem is, apologists, and sometimes Gary himself, often appeal to this unpublished and thus unscrutinized work to support the claim of Jesus' resurrection based on what they think will probably be in there when it is finally published. What's particularly weird about all this is that if you are familiar with Dr. Habermas, you will know that he is known for the minimal facts argument. He presents a list of facts that are largely undisputed by biblical scholars, and then argues that the best explanation for all of those facts taken together as a whole is the resurrection. Curiously, his facts have shrunk over time, from 12 down to 6, so half of his facts have disappeared over time as people push back against them. You'd think that as he spends more time fleshing out the evidence of the resurrection, if the resurrection were actually true, he would be getting more facts and find that the facts that support a resurrection are quite robust. But instead, rather the opposite seems to have happened. Though, to be fair, we can't really know until he actually publishes something.
Based on more than 2,000 academic sources, Professor Habermas identified several pieces of evidence on which the vast majority of scholars agree.
Yep, here come the minimal facts. I hadn't heard the over 2,000 sources claim before, but that does sound like the kind of thing that Habermas would say.
Scholars from the left and the right, scholars who are believers and non-believers, and by vast majority, he means agreement in the 90%+ range.
Maybe, but how well scholars agree on these facts does not say anything about whether or not they agree with Dr. Habermas' conclusion as to where these facts point.
So his case is not based on the inspiration or trustworthiness of the Bible. It's based on claims granted by virtually all scholars on the subject, even the skeptical ones.
Yeah, but some of the facts are like the most mundane facts you could possibly imagine. Jesus died is one of them. Okay, anyone who thinks that Jesus was an historical figure will agree that he died for sure, because everybody dies at some point. It would be far more controversial if he had not died. Oh, but he died by crucifixion. Okay, so he died, something that everyone does eventually, and he did it by one of the most common execution methods of the time. Sure, maybe he's in the minority of people in that most people didn't piss off the Romans enough to warrant a crucifixion, but again, this is such a mundane claim that it's not even worth objecting to.
Well, what did he find? Even across this diverse spectrum, almost everyone accepts 12 historical facts.
Ooh, we're going bold with the list of 12 facts. Okay, I doubt they're going to go through these in great detail in the last 51 seconds remaining in this video, so let's just quickly read through them. Jesus died by crucifixion. Sure. He was buried. Sure. His death caused the disciples to despair and lose hope. Gary no longer includes this item on his list, so we can ignore that. The tomb was found empty. This is probably the single most important item. Now, even if I grant this, there are a myriad of explanations that make a lot more sense than a resurrection that account for all the data, but the problem is, this is another item that Gary no longer includes on the list. The most important minimal fact is no longer a minimal fact. Next up, disciples had experiences that they believed were the appearance of Jesus. I'd amend this one to say that people believed that the disciples had experiences that they believed were the appearance of Jesus, as we don't actually have any writings from the disciples themselves, and even if we count the books of the Bible written in their names, none of those books ever make the claim that the author personally saw a risen Jesus, and even if they did, you can't tell just from someone's writing reading it thousands of years later whether they actually believed what they were writing or not. Proclamation of the resurrection took place at the beginning of the church. That basically amounts to Christians believed Christian things for as long as Christianity has existed. And while there is a lot of variation in Christian belief, especially in the early days of Christianity, I can agree that the belief in the resurrection has always been a core tenet of the religion. They preach the resurrection in Jerusalem, not on the modern list of facts. Gospel message centered on the death and resurrection of Jesus. Oddly, this one isn't on the modern list either, which seems weird to me, as this is one that I'd certainly be willing to grant. But I guess you could argue that other gospel messages were taking precedence, perhaps that repentance and forgiveness of sins is the central message, and Jesus' death and resurrection is simply the mechanism by which this central message is accomplished. Orthodox Jews who believed in Jesus switched their worship day to Sunday. Also not on the modern list of facts, and also I'm not sure how that would even point to a resurrection. The final two are the conversions of James and Paul. The conversion of James being rather dubious, we have no writings from James, and even if I grant that the book of James was written by James, he doesn't even mention the resurrection in that book, so we don't know what he believes about the resurrection from that. Though this is one of my favorite books of the Bible, because this is where we find the Bible saying to put your money where your mouth is. Faith without works is dead. Actually do the charitable shit that you're supposed to be doing. Don't just say you have faith. But sure, let's just grant that James converted. Even after all I've said, it's actually pretty uncontroversial. And yeah, Paul converted after he had a personal experience as well. Not with a physically risen Jesus, mind you, just a vision, but he did convert. Future Rhino cutting in, somehow I missed crossing off he was buried from the list, possibly because the way it's worded here is so uncontroversial. However, on Dr. Habermas' original list, you are meant to infer that the burial is a tomb burial, not just that he was thrown in a mass grave, as Dr. Habermas himself admits would have been the most common method of disposing of crucifixion victims' bodies.
Most probably, Jesus' body would have been thrown into a mass grave. So my question is, what is the earliest historical evidence we have of Jews being thrown, criminals being thrown into a mass grave? Does it come at the time of Nero, around 70 AD, or does it come before then? Because it seems to me like that's the earliest evidence that we have of these mass graves.
Okay, first of all, you're going to be hard put to nail exact historical references when it was done. But I would concede, and many would, that that's what happened to most people.
And as this is most definitely not an undisputed fact, it is not on the modern list. So what this all breaks down to is Jesus was executed by one of the most common methods of execution at the time. People believed that the disciples had experiences of some kind. Christians believed Christian things, and at least two people converted to the religion. These barely point to the existence of Christianity itself, much less to the resurrection. Like, I'll grant that many prominent people converted, no need to just keep it to James and Paul. We know that early churches met in their wealthier members' homes, as those were the only places they had access to that would fit everybody. In order to have met in wealthy Christian homes, there had to first be wealthy Christians, and I will freely admit that being wealthy probably means they were also prominent members of their community. So why you would just stop at two prominent members of their communities converting is just baffling to me. Especially James. He's the brother of Jesus. If Jesus were lying, surely he would have known. Except James was one of at least four brothers of Jesus, and he's the only one who converted. So what the conversion of James says is that if the resurrection is true, then either Jesus was a dick to three of his brothers and didn't bother appearing to them, or his brothers just knew that he was full of shit, so James was pretending to have seen him resurrected in order to continue his ministry. To what end? Who knows? Maybe he saw financial opportunity since the members of the church were being told to give extra money to the church leaders. Maybe he had a bereavement hallucination and honestly came to believe. Maybe something else. We don't know. But a 25% success rate at converting those who knew you best suggests that something fishy is going on there. Maybe even fishy enough to feed 5,000 people.
Pause the video and check out this list.
Already done.
Notice that this list includes all the most important elements of the biblical storyline.
That list does. Its modern counterpart, however, does not.
Jesus was crucified and buried, his tomb was later found empty, and people, including hardened skeptics, changed radically after claiming to see Jesus alive again. The question becomes this: if an overwhelming majority of experts agree that these things actually occurred, what theory best explains these facts?
Pretty much any theory that isn't the resurrection. Now, sure, some do a better job of it than others. Look at you, Swoon Theory, you just suck. Go home. But given that the modern list is missing the empty tomb, I'd say that a couple select hallucinations fit the bill quite nicely. You could get by with just two, Peter and Paul. But more are possible, and as the new disciples were likely emotional and distraught, as Habermas says in the older list of facts, they would have been particularly susceptible to bereavement hallucinations. And unfortunately, this is an area that I now have personal experience with, I can tell you that they can be quite convincing. Now, let them happen at a time when people were less informed about that sort of thing than we are today, and they don't know that this is a normal part of the grieving process, so they talk about how they spoke with their deceased loved one, and then each time the story is retold, it grows a little bit. That's all that's necessary for Christianity to have begun, and it covers everything that is on Habermas' modern minimal facts list.
Can you think of one that fits the data better than resurrection?
Yes. Anything non-supernatural fits the data better than resurrection, pretty much by definition. The idea that aliens were watching Jesus' life and got bummed out by Jesus' death, and so came down to Earth disguised as Jesus and some angels before ascending physically back up to their ship, fits the data better than an actual resurrection. Because pretty much definitionally, anything non-supernatural will be more probable than an actual miracle, because a miracle would not be miraculous if it were probable.
And if Jesus did rise from the dead, could he really have been just a man?
Yes. According to your own theology, yes. Maybe he was just a man who was thrown into a grave and whose body happened to touch the bones of some other dead person who was on the same level as Elisha, and so he rose from the dead, because that's what happens when you touch a dead body to such a person's bones, apparently.
Okay, I'm out of time, but you're not. There's a strong, rational case that can be made that Jesus is God.
Rational? Depends how you define rational. Strong? Not a chance. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from George Smith, who says, "If you woke up tomorrow morning and it was suddenly impossible to make money off religion, do you think religion would go away?" That's an interesting question, and I think it depends a lot on the individuals. There are plenty who have legitimate, honest, sincere belief in their religion, so no, I don't think it would go away. But I think a lot of the more harmful aspects of religion would go away. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Joel Osteen would probably go away. The Catholic Church would, if not disappear, change drastically. Pastors who are still pasting would also have to have real jobs. This is an interesting thought experiment with interesting implications. Thanks for watching. Thanks to this week's PayPal hero, Brady, and special thanks as always to my patrons, iOS Tilt Bill Gamer, Bryn Pound, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, and all the rest, who are the 12 minimal facts that prove the existence of my channel. If you'd like to be whittled down and reduced as we learn more about you, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist. Links to social media, all the ways to support the channel, and to my other projects can be found at links.vicerhino.com. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!